What's one of the most pressing issues of our time? Criminal justice rose to the top. We're talking about a crisis of mass incarceration throughout this country, over approximately 2 million people incarcerated on this very day. And what does it mean to be an institution that is laser focused on that issue? There's not many foundations out there that have this as an exclusive issue, and so that made us very unique. But I think the approach for us was really about how can we support organizations who are directly impacted by these systems that they want to change, who themselves might have been incarcerated at one point, because we really believe that those who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution, and we try to just embed that in all of the grant making that we do.
We'll discuss race and how it plays a factor, and how we didn't even talk about this topic because we were afraid.
A Black Executive Perspective.
We are coming to you live from the BEP studio for another thought-provoking episode of a Black Executive Perspective podcast, a safe space where we discuss all matters regarding race, culture, and those uncomfortable topics people tend to avoid. I'm your host, Tony Tidbit.
And I'm your co-host, Chris P. Reed. And before we get started, we want to remind you to check out our partners at Code M Magazine, whose mission is saving the Black family by first saving the Black man. Check them out at CodeMMagazine2Ms.com.
Yeah, definitely check them out. And today, we have a very special guest. We sit down with Thina Robinson Mock, Vice President of Programs at Public Welfare Foundation, a racial justice lawyer and philanthropic leader working at the intersection of community power, youth justice, criminal justice reform, and racial justice. At a time when justice and democratic norms are under pressure, the Public Welfare Foundation is investing in grassroots organization building real reform from the ground up. Today's conversation explores coalition building, community-led justice, youth justice reform, and why restorative racial just solutions matter more now than ever. Thina Robinson Mock, welcome to a Black Executive Perspective podcast, my sister.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And cool. Well, before we get into this deep stuff, because there's a lot of deep stuff in the bio there, before we get to that, give us a little bit about you as the person. You know, where did you grow up and a little bit about your day-to-day family type situation?
Sure. So I was born in Richmond, Virginia. Most of my family is from Virginia. Later lived in Hampton. That is a big part of my sort of origin story. Most of my family is from that region. Went to Hampton University for undergrad. Then on to law school in New Orleans, which is one of my favorite cities. Lived there for about 10 years and practiced law after that.
Okay. Well, you know what you talked about, Hampton being pivotal there. Take us through a high level of your career as far as like what made you decide to do this. And then because it's not a very glamorous type of situation. So what made you decide to dive in and take, you know, jump on the grenade for us folks?
Yeah. That's a good point. I ask myself this a lot. But I've always kind of been interested in social justice and racial justice. I was one of these kids who watched Eyes on the Prize documentaries on PBS back in the day. I don't know if people remember that. But I was really taken by just images of folks fighting for justice. It was something that I was deeply interested in and curious about. When I was in the fourth grade, I led a petition to protest the cafeteria food in my school. Got suspended for that little protest activity.
Did you do a hunger strike?
I probably should have given the mystery meat that they were serving, but.
The goulash.
Yeah, did a little petition protest. My mom was called, went to the principal's office, but she later said to me, you know, I think you should think about becoming a lawyer because it seems like you have a lot that you want to say and you have some things that you want to change. And so she, I think at an early age, helped me to kind of channel some of that, some of that little feisty energy into a career. And then I've had just a range of experiences that really hooked me into criminal justice. And it's just one of those issues that I think early on, I just could not look away from.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, look, we need people like yourself who are active, who's actually, you know, pushing back and making sure that everyday Americans like Chris and myself and everybody else have people that's holding people accountable, right? And that's really key. So I'm glad you watched the PBS thing, and I'm glad you did the, you know, the petition against I think it was Chili Mac, right? It was that Chili Mac in the cafeteria. You don't know what it was, right? So without that, you wouldn't be here. But here's the thing, though. We chatted a few weeks ago. You're very busy. It took a while for us to put this together, okay, just to be honest. You're all over. You're being requested on multiple platforms. You have a PR team. I met with them. You know, they looked me up and down, all this type stuff. The question I have for you is, why did you want to come on a Black Executive Perspective podcast, talk about this topic?
Yeah, I think this is an important platform, of course, for Black executives, but also just for the discourse and really just bringing issues to light. I think this is a forum where we can engage in some conversation, but also just really hear from others and just hopefully raise the visibility about issues that are really pressing today.
Well, that's why we're glad you're here, and we're glad you took, invested the time to come. So, my sister, you seem like you're chomping at the bit. You ready to talk about it?
I'm ready to talk about it.
All right, let's do it. Let's talk about it.
Absolutely. So let's get a baseline for the folks who may not be aware of the Public Welfare Foundation. Give us a little bit about that, how you got excited or involved, or did they come and find you? You found them, how that all works, and give us some feedback on help us get centered on what that's all about.
Sure. So the Public Welfare Foundation is a private foundation based in Washington, D.C. We've been around now for a little bit over 75 years. And the mission of the foundation was really about, it sort of started with a wide pair of words, very vague name. A lot of people are like, public welfare, what does that mean? But it really is exactly that. It's doing work in the for the public welfare, in the public interest of others. And so the foundation for really almost 80 years now has funded work that really is about driving change and transformation. Started with really early beginnings in 1947, doing work. The foundation's dollars and resources really came from the newspaper business. So kind of fun fact in terms of origin story. But looking now into to 2026, the issue that we focus on exclusively is criminal justice reform and transformation, both youth and adult justice reform. And, you know, it's interesting. I found and heard about the organization from a dear colleague of mine in philanthropy, who talked a lot about how the Public Welfare Foundation was an institution that really just practiced what it preached and was just such a respected institution out there in terms of supporting community-based organizations. Philanthropy can be a really interesting industry. I mean, we're in the business of funding work. And so I think whenever you have money involved and issues involved, you want to make sure you're doing that work with care. And Public Welfare Foundation just had a reputation for just doing incredible work. So I knew I wanted to focus on criminal justice reform, in part because of my years as an attorney, but I wanted to be on the philanthropic side of that work and figure out how I could advance that work by providing resources. And so this just gave me an opportunity to do that.
Wow, that is fantastic. And, you know, Chris made a good point, and you just kind of spoke to it. So, you know, words paint pictures, okay? So when we think of public welfare reform, I mean, just foundation, people immediately go to, you know, this is a handout organization, okay, for Black people or marginalized groups, whatever the case may be, right? And, you know, for you to provide that type of history in terms of this was established in 1947 by the newspaper publisher Charles Marsh, right? Nobody would know that. They just wouldn't, okay? And it's for doing the best for society. Nobody would know that. The question I have is, how did it go from that in 1947, or maybe it did, to criminal justice reform and stuff to that nature? Speak a little, tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, the issues that the foundation has supported have really evolved over the years. I mean, we have funded everything from housing justice to civil legal rights. But criminal justice has been a predominant thread in the work that we've funded really since, I want to say, the early 2000s. And then when our CEO and president, Candace Jones, came on board, She came with, who you all know, she's been on the show.
Oh, yes, that's Lord.
That's our new sister.
Chi-Town stepping up.
Kerr and Chris are from Chicago together. They kicked me off the show because I'm from Detroit.
there's a lot of Midwest action going on here.
That's right.
Yes, but she came to the foundation with a background advancing criminal justice initiatives and really set out to shape the strategic direction of the foundation and really taking a step back to say, what's one of the most pressing issues of our time? Criminal justice rose to the top. We're talking about a crisis of mass incarceration throughout this country, over approximately 2 million people incarcerated on this very day. And what does it mean to be an institution that is laser focused on that issue? There's not many foundations out there that have this as an exclusive issue, and so that made us very unique. But I think the approach for us was really about how can we support organizations who are directly impacted by these systems that they want to change, who themselves might have been incarcerated at one point, because we really believe that those who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution, and we try to just embed that in all of the grant making that we do. So I think it was a journey to get here, but as we go into this work, you know, year after year, it feels like we're definitely on the right track in terms of issues that are most pressing of today.
Let me say this, because we have a knack for making uncomfortable conversations comfortable. So here's the uncomfortable part. Prison is big business, and y'all trying to mess with the church's money. And so in the concept of swimming upstream and fighting a good fight, me and Candace had this conversation as well. How difficult is it for you to go in, and what you in essence do is create a level of accountability legally, right? You use their words against them, and people don't like that, especially in this day and age with this administration. People don't like to be called on the carpet or called out, or, you know, held their feet to, they're having their feet held to the fire. How has that transformed, or how do you get up every day ready to fight the good fight, like emotionally?
Oh, that's a big question.
She already wore out.
You ain't lying. Oh, yeah. 4 cups of coffee.
Yes. I mean, this is a big issue. You know, we're in philanthropy, we're often in the position of, you know, we're funding other organizations who are kind of on the front line of this work, right? So, you know, we're funding those leaders who are going to the Department of Corrections and facing, you know, some of these obstacles and facing off against the big business of prisons. It is truly a big business. It can, and it can often feel very overwhelming, to the point where I think those of us who may not be as close to working on these issues are just like, you know what, there's nothing we can do. Let's just kind of throw up our hands. How do you tackle the system of mass incarceration? But it's just really brick by brick is kind of how I like to think about it. And I also try to remind myself that when we are doing this work and supporting other leaders to do this work, we have done so much in terms of, you know, what we have overcome as a people with far less, right? And so if we are able to give grants to help fuel that work, even though it's hard, it's like we just can't complain. It's like we have been in this fight before, even though it may have looked a little bit different. I think you just kind of have to fortify yourself with support from, you know, those who are both doing the work, but also just a little bit of joy as well, so that you can get through it. But it's a tough issue to tackle, for sure.
Dina, let me ask you this, though, because so everybody, the audience is on the same page. Like, tell us a little bit, like when you say you guys fund or back, you know, different organizations, give us some examples of those organizations and some of the things that you guys are able to provide. And then number two, tie into coalition building is a big thing for you guys, right? Because at the end of the day, the more people that's involved, the more partnerships you're creating, the more scale that you can get out in terms of, you know, promoting the message, getting people involved. So speak to that as well, if you can.
Absolutely. So we're in the business of funding community-based organizations who are engaged in everything from advocacy to community organizing. They might be engaged in narrative or media strategies, all in the service of advancing criminal justice reform, all in the service of saying, instead of incarceration, what can we do to both keep people safe, but also not ruin lives? And we know that that's what incarceration does. It just ruins lives. It takes people out of their communities, out of their homes, It also costs a lot of money. And what would it look like if we were to invest those dollars into giving people what they needed so that people could be whole and thrive? And so we're in the business of both sort of defending against policies that are harmful and trying to make sure that we're supporting organizations that are working to get people home and change systems and those kinds of things. But we're also kind of in the business of world building. We want to support organizations that are saying, well, how can we do this differently? What would it look like, for example, if we were to have an alternative crisis response line instead of 911 for those who are in need? And there's an organization here in Atlanta who we support that does that work. Or what would it look like if we were to support young people to be advocates for better youth justice policies? And there are organizations who we fund who are doing that, you know, mentoring the next generation. Our work of late has really been about that coalition building that you just spoke of, Tony. And the really the premise behind all of that is that we can't do this work alone. I've been in philanthropy long enough to know that you can't fund one organization to tackle all of the problems that we are dealing with when it comes to the criminal justice system. But what would it look like if you were to support a coalition, a number of groups who are working together with a common goal, a common strategy to actually advance change? And we've seen evidence of this throughout history. I mean, look at all of our various social movements. Look at the civil rights movement. There was never one person out there leading the way. It was always a coalition of people working together. And so we've been really intentional lately, of late, thinking about how we can do that better in our funding work.
You know what? It's interesting because I was thinking about modern day abolitionists as it relates to you guys. And the concept of getting a coalition going, everything can't be a home run, right? You got to get on base to score. And so you got to connect with smaller groups and get people to kind of pony up and believe in one another.
If you like what you hear and want to join us on this journey of making uncomfortable conversations comfortable, please subscribe to a Black Executive Perspective podcast on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hit subscribe now to stay connected for more episodes that challenge, inspire, and lead the change.
That has to be a difficult endeavor as well, because that's not the way society is structured currently. So any idea of you identifying folks to partner with, how do you get them to believe and trust and partner with each other in that regard? Because everybody has agendas and some people don't see the big picture. So you guys are bringing that big picture. You know what I'm saying? Absolutely, Tom. And leaders, especially leaders. Like, I got something and I'm passionate about it. I don't really want you in my Kool-Aid, blah, blah, blah. Is that, besides being able to tie them to financial support, are there other things that you guys do to help them understand where they fit or weave into the bigger ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, I love the whole phrase, high impact, low ego. I think that's what it takes for coalition building and working together. And such a great point, Chris, points that you made. I mean, this work can be hard. I mean, one thing that it's interesting, the organizations that we fund, they teach us a lot about what it means to, you know, advance change. And so it's really, a lot of times we're kind of listening to what they have to say around what they need. And we did a survey of our partners last year in terms of, you know, what are some things that the foundation can do to help boost their work. And support for coalition building was something that rose to the top. They were saying, you know, we actually do have folks who want to work together, but we need the resources to do it. We need somebody to help coordinate us, someone to help align us a little bit. And so at the top of this year, we announced a competitive grant process called the Igniting Futures Youth Justice Grant, really calling out across our network to say, we've heard from you, we are listening, we've heard that people are interested in scaling up coalitions. We have some grant dollars that we would like to give out. Give us your best ideas. And we had an incredible response to that, and we were able to launch that effort and select two organizations for that work just a couple of months ago this spring. And so what we've learned is that it can be very hard bringing people together, especially across, like, you know, across various perspectives, multiracial coalitions, experience, all of that. But I think the best coalitions that do really well are ones that can say, we don't have to agree on everything, but if there are some common goals or a North Star for our work that we can agree on, then let's go. And so we have found that the coalitions that are able to do that do really well.
Let me ask you a question. Tom, let me jump in.
Yep.
It reminded me of this, and this is inspired. You are inspirational, so this is what's going on right now. This is real-time inspiration.
You know,
Tony
right.
had made a comment that went viral a while ago, and it was talking about how people tie the presidency into actual change that could affect them, when in fact, it's that local stuff. It's your local person. It's your alderman. It's your this, that. You know, you got to start, charity starts at home type situation.
Yeah.
How do you navigate the waters of your big company? I mean, you guys do big things, and you're, you know, you got a DC and blah, blah, blah. You're the big kids. How do you then get those folks who need to make sure that they take care of things where they are to understand that and appreciate that? Because sometimes we get too far ahead of ourselves. So you got to kind of bring them back in. How do you guys inspire that? Because that's interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, we've done something really interesting over the past couple of months. We've been hosting these virtual peer learning series called The Collective. So a little plug for The Collective. It's an amazing little series. But our partners are basically teaching us what it means to take things one at a time, what it means to kind of stay the course in the work. For criminal justice reform, it's so much of it is local. So much of it is all about what's happening in your city, your state, to your point. And, you know, people often talk about how we need to change narratives in the work that we do, because there's a lot of misconceptions and narratives about folks who are justice involved, or even young people. You know, lately, young people have been blamed for everything under the sun in terms of all the harms of the world. If I see another update about the teen takeovers, you know, like, they're, you know, it's just young people are this, young people are that. But what I've learned is that sometimes you can achieve narrative change by just a small step of taking a moment to talk to your neighbor about what it means to, rather than support young people who might be in crisis, to incarcerate them. Like, what's the impact of that? And some of those very small steps and conversations can be the big things. And so there's a lot of that in this work, especially when it comes to criminal justice.
So I got to ask you this, right? And Chris knows I'm a big movie guy. You ever see the movie Panther?
Yes.
Athena? Okay. Mm-hmm. You remember the beginning of the movie? It came out years ago. But you remember in the beginning of the movie when they got all arrested because they were saying, we will not be moved, we'll be not be moved. And then they're in jail, right?
Yeah.
And I forget who it was, but a couple of them said, we need to do something now. And the preacher said, what we need to do is pray. And they were like, we tired of praying. We ain't praying no more. So the reason I'm bringing that up, how much of this is, let's come up with a narrative, which seems like that ain't a lot of action, versus we just had 5 kids that went to jail right here in Memphis, or whatever the case may be, and they're railroading them in, and we need somebody to come in here and bring lawyers. So talk a little bit about, you know, the policy, but also from an action and performance standpoint in terms of what you guys provide.
Yes. For us, we're in the business of figuring out a couple of things. You know, we have 10 different sites where we fund our work across the country. Primarily, the lion's share of our work is sort of concentrated in the Deep South and the Midwest, because those are the areas of the country where we tend to see very high rates of incarceration and lack of investment. And so for us in philanthropy, like, part of my job and the job of our team is really to figure out who is out there in places like Memphis, as you just named, or other places, who's out there, what organizations and leaders are out there who are leading work, who are building a little bit of momentum around calling for change and transformation, and what could our resources, our funding do to help them take that work to the next level and
Got it.
So that, for, you know, just practically speaking, it looks like a grant. It looks like a grant to an organization. It looks like us working in collaboration with them to figure out, well, what is it that you're trying to achieve, and how can we essentially help you get there? But also, who can we connect you with? Who also might be doing work in another city that's very similar so that you can bring that to the city that you where you are.
Got it. Got it. So you provide the fuel in terms of their action, correct?
Yes.
And so, and then they can accelerate that, scale that out. Give me an example, though. Like, tell us, like, give us some examples. I know you did some stuff. You did a great coalition work in Tennessee and Michigan in terms of bringing those. So give us some examples specifically of that.
Yes. So, I mentioned the coalition building grant that we launched at the top of the year. It's called Igniting Futures. It's really all about helping organizations who want to come together as a coalition to advance youth justice reforms. And so we selected two coalitions, one in Tennessee, one in Michigan. They're both very interesting jurisdictions because they have very unique problems, but also unique opportunities. In Tennessee, our partners there, our community partners, are dealing with a pretty hostile climate to youth justice reform. We don't fund C4 or legislative activity, but what I can say is it's a pretty hostile political environment. No, that's an understatement, okay? And so with that in mind, you have a highly punitive sort of culture of decision makers there who want to expand youth incarceration, who want to build more prisons, who want to make sure that these laws are very punitive, that people don't have the opportunity for parole, those kinds of things. In this instance, the Youth Justice Coalition in Tennessee that we will be funding is going to be working on figuring out, one, how can we stop the expansion of youth prisons in the state, but also how can we work with local organizations and other concerned citizens who care a lot about youth justice, but need a place to organize and figure out where they can go to call for change. And so this group of organizations in Tennessee is gonna be working on figuring out how to sort of build up momentum for that, how to get people excited and energized about youth justice, and just how to change the narrative. In Michigan, though, it's sort of a different story. You have a political climate there that is more favorable to reform. And one of the lead organizations that we supported out there has been working really for probably about a decade now to try to advance youth justice reforms. And so they've actually had some pretty powerful wins. Community-based alternatives have been supported in law to be funded, but you still have local county leaders who they have a great law on the books, but they don't exactly know what to do with it. And so this coalition is going to come in to say, we have incredible ideas. Talk to our community members, talk to our families and young people about how we think these resources should be deployed for youth justice. So both of those groups will work together in a coalition to figure out how they can do that and also to learn from each other.
Let me ask you this, because it's interesting what you guys are doing in the fact that you get involved and black and brown folks are disproportionately affected by this, but the things that you affect and the change that you're able to accomplish is agnostic. If it's good, it's civil, right? It's civil. And I think people miss that mark. They think that you do something and it's only affecting us. It's only affecting us mostly because we're disproportionately being, you know, succumbed to the system. And so when you do have a reformation and you do change some things to the benefit, it's to the benefit of all. Let's just clear that up right here and right there. One of the things that you said that was really interesting to me is a conversation I was having with my wife. My wife was looking at this house, and it was a bigger house, and we don't need a bigger house. Let's just put that out there on wax right now. We do not need a bigger house. Reason why I think we don't need a bigger house is because when you buy a bigger house, you got to buy more furniture. So as simple as that, and I know this is, I'm not simplifying the concept, but instead of building more prisons, why don't you cut it off at the source of why we need more prisons? Why wouldn't you put your emphasis or your money or your foundation into that? And instead of building something and then being compelled to fill it up.
But it's easy to do that. It's buddy, but that don't take no brain power. All right. And plus you'll get people to jump on faster because at the end of the day, like she just got finished saying about the team thing, right? The teams are out of crate. Mm-hmm. They're out of control, right?
Yep,
but
yep,
when
yep,
they
yep,
were
yep.
when other people were 15, 16, they were saying the same shit about them.
Right,
all right.
Right, right.
So at the end of the day, If it's easy to throw up some infrastructure and say the solution to this is more prisons, and people think, mm-hmm. okay, that makes sense, right? And so to your point, they don't want to think the next two steps to figure mm-hmm. out the root cause, right? And maybe mm-hmm. it's not even a root cause. Maybe it's all made, I don't want to say made up, but, you know, multiple things can be true at the same time, right? That's right. And so, but you got to be willing to be figured it out and be strategic, and that's where, so Thina, I'm jumping in. So I don't have no law degree, but I'm just jumping in. So you answer
just stayed
the question.
At Holiday Inn Express.
Yeah, I just stayed at Holiday Inn Express, right? So at the end of the day, you answer the question, but those are my thoughts.
I mean, you don't even need a law degree for this conversation at all. You are spot on. I mean, it is so easy to say, let's do more of the same. But much harder, I think, to have the what I call radical imagination to say, well, what could we do differently? Right. You know, right. It would really, for us to think about a world without prisons, we would have to go to the source and root of the problem, you know, that we're mm-hmm. seeing. And it would also really mean that we would need to start rejecting some of the, you know, dehumanizing narratives about people, because, you know, we start to think, well, certain people deserve to be in prison, you know, or this Correct. Is what they're built for. And so, you know, it's physical, because we've got to think about these new structures, but you also have to kind of dismantle some of the, like, you know, get into the psychology of what it means, what racism really means in this country.
Right.
And I think prisons just manifest that entirely, you know. Things can definitely be different. And I think, like, we're kind of in the business of futurism over here. You know, we really have to try to create a world we haven't quite seen before, at least not in our lifetime. But I always try to remind people, like, prisons haven't always been with us, you know. They and certainly not in this way.
That's a good
right?
point.
And so it can be different. And so I think you know, to do this work and to stay in it, you kind of have to have this very, like, audacious, sometimes ridiculous optimism that things can be different, you know, if you want to change it. So it's interesting.
I think what's tough about it is when I have a investment in incarceration, and you come along and say, well, I'm not going to supply you. It's a supply and demand. It's economic. Everything's economics to me, right? And so you're diametrically opposed to me making millions and millions of dollars off of the suffrage of these people, because you're trying to create rules and laws and protocols that don't allow for the suffrage of these people. But without, and fortunately, I didn't bring any clips or have anything specific, but it's been shown over and over again that in certain subsets of the society, people are inappropriately sentenced or inappropriately tasked, and you can't tell me now I'm starting to sound crazy. You can't tell me this don't have a financial component on the back end where somebody's lobbying to judges or whomever. Everybody can be touched, right? That's from a movie, Tony. Everybody can be touched. And the concept is, but it's hard to prove that out. How often do you run into situations where you see this township or this place on the map, and for whatever reason is disproportionate so badly, and the numbers bear out, but we can't do anything about it? Have you ever run into a situation where it seems like there's nothing, it's a dismal kind of outcome no matter what?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I think when you look out across the criminal justice field, there's probably a lot of examples of that. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at certainly the sheer number of people who are incarcerated, the racial disparities alone, when you look at how prisons are the economic drivers of certain, you know, communities, like, everybody works at the prison, you know, and so so to take away the prison,
but there you go,
jobs, you know.
Like,
there's it's deep, it's sort of this web of injustice that has, like, a lot of tentacles everywhere. There have been some interesting stories about for years about, you know, exposing how prisons, prison labor is used for some of the products that we all use every day. And so, you know, I think when we think about what it means to dismantle these systems, it's certainly, you know, getting people home and figuring out ways for us to do things differently so that we can support people rather than incarcerate them. But it also is very much, you know, kind of going in and dissecting, you know, what are the sort of economic levers here that are keeping this system in operation? I mean, when you think about, you know, I'm a history buff. I love history. So, you know, when you yeah. study slavery and the historical legacy of that, and you look at how so many systems were involved in just even upholding the very system of slavery, I think it gives you a sense of what we're dealing with mass incarceration. I mean, everything from insurance firms who, you know, had bonds. I mean, it was very deep. And so similarly, we're up against that as well. But I, again, going back to this notion of you just take it one brick at a time, you know, one step at a time. And I like to think about, you know, what I hear from our partners who are just like, there's a partner in Louisiana who we support, an organization, Vote. Norris Henderson is the founder of that organization. And he has this whole saying where he's just like, we have to fight one day longer than them. And this notion that, like, you know, we just have to, it's one step at a time, but also this is an endurance game. And I think that for those of us, you know, in this work where it can seem really insurmountable, that's the kind of approach we have to have.
I mean, listen, let's be fair, though, too. I think Chris asked this earlier, right? Because it is like trying to push a boulder uphill, right? It can be daunting, but it also can be, you know, exhausting. And sometimes people run out of gas, right? And you know, you just talked about history, and we're talking hundreds of years of this, right? And you're creating this coalition of all these organizations, and you're saying, hey, I got your back. We're going to go out and fight, fight, fight. But at the end of the day, they keep coming up, and yeah, they may make some margin here and this and that. So talk a little bit, how do you keep the momentum going? When laws are coming out at you, a million, like, let's just be fair. Let's look at 2024, you know, after the election, when we taking this away and we're doing this and we're doing that and we're eliminating this and this and that. When a couple years ago, we thought we were making progress, and now it's being erased and taking away like that. All right. So to be fair, that can be psychologically like, I mean, what are we doing here? We put in all this effort and now it's being eliminated. So how do you keep the momentum going? I love what you just got from saying about the partner who says, you know, one day at a time. But let's be fair, though, too, right? That makes sense. But there's a reality of it, too, in terms of the effort, the mind games, all the things that you're doing. And then you finally say, hip, hip, hooray. And then at a stroke of a pen, it's wiped out.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is so real. And some days are harder than others, you know, especially reading the headlines, right? We try to stay attuned to all of the various headlines taking shape in the sites where we fund. And certainly, for example, many of our partners across the Deep South have been experiencing a lot of really harsh headlines as it relates to everything from criminal justice to democracy and all of that. You know, I think that for me, I find a lot of inspiration in those who have come before me. I mean, again, going back to the black and white eyes on the prize, right? Like, I literally watched an episode of that not too long ago so that I could be reminded of what the Freedom Riders in Mississippi were up against, you know, in terms of voting rights, and felt both, you know, devastated, but also inspired at the same time. And I think we just have to remember that this work is hard, but we, you know, it sounds cliche to say, but we have signed up for hard things. And, you know, every now and then you do get some wins. And so, like, I try to kind of hold on to that too, because you don't lose them all. You don't win them all, but you also don't lose them all. And I think that you, like, that's that perspective. You have to kind of keep that in this work. The other piece is that progress doesn't happen in a straight line, you know, like we know.
Correct. There's a Correct. Lot
of different ways and avenues that it can go down. And so I think that perspective, maybe it comes from all of my years now, but, you know, that perspective, that wisdom in knowing that it may not be a quick fix, but it just feels to me like we, you know, I don't know, I feel very called to do this work. And like, I have a duty to stay the course. I just don't think I have an option to, you know, to not be in this fight in some way or another.
as a justice warrior, and obviously this doesn't make it 80 years without wins. So I was glad that you brought up that it's just not every day is a dismal day and we won't complain. But the concept of you being able to get a win or see a win in your time, you've said you've been doing this for a while. Can you share with us any of the wins either you had directly or you have been associated with that have reinvigorated you or made you say, damn, that's why. That, okay, I was wondering, God, you know, that's why right. we I'm on this path.
Exactly,
and that's what,
exactly.
You know what I'm saying? To give you a little bit of adrenaline. Can you share something that would be uplifting for us to be able to align with?
Oh, goodness. Let's see. Well,
that smile. Hey, that smile did it all.
I love it.
That changed everything.
I love it.
About that. These hard questions here. You know, before coming into philanthropy, I practiced law. I was a youth justice attorney, would represent young people in court. And I think often back to that time because it wasn't particularly like splashy work. It did not make the news every day. But really part of my job was to make sure that the young people that I was representing did not go to jail that day. That the judge did not decide that they were going to the local detention facility, but that they could live to see another day on the outside at home with their family. And for me, it was always an incredible victory when the young person and their family that I was standing with, we were able to walk out of that courtroom together. And I keep thinking back to that, you know, again, not super splashy, but it was always such a victory to be able to say like, all right, we're going home now. And I just want that for so many of our young people, for folks who are experiencing, you know, all of the challenges of this system. I think people just need young people in particular need the ability to be able to, you know, live to see another day on the outside, in their schools, in their communities. That gives me life. But I would also just say, like, raising a little 7-year-old black boy is also, I think, a victory and something that inspires me a lot. And I just think a lot about what I'm able to pour into him as an advocate doing this work, but also a mom.
I love it.
Let me add on to that, Tone, before you jump in. It was a situation where, and this happens in many layers and fashions throughout the legal system. But a football player, NFL player named Stephon Diggs was accused of something. And he had the financial wherewithal to get a legal team and fight as opposed to pleading or anything like that. And so they aired the culmination of his trial on TV. And I'm not an emotional person. That's not a good thing, but I'm just being transparent. I'm not an emotional person. But when they said that he was innocent, and you see people that have money and have fame and have this, but when you talk about humanizing someone, when they said, we found you not guilty, and tears start, like glory, like, you know, tears start rolling. He was stoic, but tears just start rolling down his face because he looked at the inevitability of this could have been something that had me in a bad spot. I could have not went home today. Have you ever experienced a moment where it could have went one way, it went your way, and it's inconceivable the experience that you're involved in? Because that's the humanization that we tend to miss out on. We just slamming the door and throwing people away.
Yeah, I mean, there are, you know, I think about some of the stories that we hear from our partners who, for instance, we fund a lot of organizations that are led by people who are formerly incarcerated, people who have spent decades inside of prisons, who were told that they would have absolutely no opportunity to get out. And they are out. And not only are they out, but they are helping so many people, making our communities so much better. For everyone and really helping us to understand what justice truly means. And I think, you know, when I hear stories of individuals who have been, on the inside and who have said like, all right, I know exactly what that young person is going through. This is what I would recommend that we do. You know, it means so much. But also I think it means so much to us, to be able to support that work because we know that this is someone who is a credible messenger, who knows what it means to experience these types of systems. if I want to figure out how to make them better, I'm going to listen to that person because they actually know the insides and outs of it. But that's incredibly inspiring to me, again, to just know that even though you may think that there is no opportunity at all for you to, you know, see another day, that those systems won't have the last word. I think the people have the last word. And we've seen a lot of examples of that in our work.
The tough part for me, and I hope I'm not telling you something you didn't realize, the system has deep pockets. So even though you can secure, I'm straight up, you can secure funding and you can try to fight the good fight and all of that. And it's been going on for 100 years, 200 years, right? Fighting the good fight and all that. But the system is like the house in Vegas, right? The system continues to figure out a way to be the system. And because you're trying to reform the system, we're in a paradox almost. You know what I mean? And so in the idea of you being a smart person, you're a learned individual, you can get a couple wins here or there. But when they look at their murder board, you know, when they look at it, they're like, man, we so far ahead. Give them these few and far in between.
They don't even want to give you the few.
At some point in time, when will the tide, do you see it in your lifetime? Because I know I grew up in a situation where I told this story before on a podcast. My grandmother wept when Barack Obama was elected to the presidency because her father received death threats for voting Republican at the time. You know what I'm saying? It was like we that far back to where so many things have changed. She never thought in her lifetime she would see a black president. Is there a situation where you believe in your lifetime, because the good work that you guys are doing and because of things that you see now and the people that you're educating, more importantly than not, you're educating people on exposing things. Like I said, you're pulling the thread of the sweater of injustice. Mm-hmm. Is there a situation where you feel, honestly, in your lifetime, or is this something for the kids or the kids' kids, where we're going to finally see the scale starting to balance, the blind justice scale balancing out?
Yes. I mean, I like to believe that I will see that in my lifetime, but I also understand that I just because of the urgency, it's one of those things where I'm impatient. I don't want to wait that long. But I think if you're in this line of work of, you know, advancing social justice, advancing racial justice, I think you have to understand that you may not see the fruits of your labor until in your lifetime. You know, and you have to kind of get comfortable with that, right? Like because it's not going to be that immediate gratification of like we won today. So I think that's the reality of this work, and I think you have to plan for that. But every now and then you get some surprises, right? Like you do. I also think that, you know, to your point about, you know, the other side has all the money. What's interesting, this is my paraphrasing. I feel like the thing that we always underestimate, and this, you know, I think about a lot in terms of, you know, historical examples, but like, I feel like the people have always had the power, you know. We're certainly dealing with a lot of different conditions these days. Like, I think about Montgomery bus boycott, which lasted a really long time. People forget that was a year.
We talk about that on here a lot.
Yeah, a year.
Right? Like, it was not 2 days. And conditions are different now, for sure. But I think it was such a great example of people power. And also discipline. And I think, what would it look like for us to be able to exercise that? I think we can get there. But certainly, we didn't have the money for that fight, right? But we had the organizing apparatus. And so that's a glimmer of light, is that, you know, it is possible, but I think the strategy looks a little bit different in 2026. And that's what we have to unlock and figure out.
I appreciate
that, and I do too. I love that you make me feel better when you realistic about it, and you get on your Moses Martin Luther King and say, I might not get there with you. You know what I'm saying? I might not get there with you. You know what I'm saying?
I love the optimism, and I think if you're 100% involved and you have 2 feet in cement, that's how you have to think. You have to think that you can make a difference and you're going to see that difference. You can't be thinking because it won't last, right? It won't last. Right. You won't last, right? But the final question I have for you, Thena, you know, as a black woman, right, and a racial justice lawyer in leadership, what have you learned All right. When it comes to power, patience, you kind of spoke a little bit resilience, but protecting your purpose. Let's dive into that, because let's be fair too. Okay. You are a Black woman. Okay. And this ain't easy. It ain't easy for nobody. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, for our Black women, this can, the thing, some of the things that you may deal with, we don't deal with. Right. So talk a little bit about what you've learned through this journey.
Mm-hmm. Well, how much time do you have? No, don't. I mean, lots of lessons, you know. I think in past, I'm sure in past discussions, you all have talked a lot about this notion of imposter syndrome that comes up. And I think what I've learned over the years is that it's such a waste of time. It's just such a distraction, I think, to not sort of believe that you have the right to be in the spot that you're in. And so if I could go back and talk to my, you know, I don't know, my 20-year-old self.
Yes.
I might say, like, don't waste time with that. Like, you know, like, you've got so much ground to cover. You could get there a little bit faster if you could remove some of that self-doubt, you know, that you might have. So step into that. I also think that, you know, as a leader, as a Black woman, you know, we're called to do a lot of things. And, you know, I think that, you know, one thing I've learned over the years and that I'm trying to live into is just do the thing, whatever it may be, whatever that hope and aspiration may be, because the conditions are always impossible. You know, I think we often try to wait for the precise conditions to do a thing. And I think what I've learned is that you just have to start walking. You just have to start going. And sometimes you'll figure it out. So, you know, I think about that. I'm inspired by, you know, some of the, I'm inspired by some of the young folks I'm seeing out here. I also think that it's important to just make sure that you, you know, there's a lot of ideas out there about like self-care and very individualistic. I've really lately been embracing this idea of it's really about community care. We've got to kind of make sure to check in with each other and pull each other along. So this idea of a very individualistic sort of mode as a leader, as a Black executive, it really is about the team, the crew. It really is about sort of that collaborative and that collective. See that in our work, but also in leadership too.
Cool. I love it, cool. My girl. I love it. So, you know, I was going to say, I don't know if we're going to go to final thoughts, but I mean, well, yeah, you kind of dropped the mic.
That's my drop. Yeah, she did. She did. She put it down.
The mic on that. So I'm like, no, that was awesome. That was awesome.
I love it.
That's a really good lesson, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let me ask this as we wrap up, because one of the things that I get from you and all the people that you work with is there's a high level of passion, and you can't go to school for that, right? You can't go to school for passion. So even though you're an accomplished attorney and different people are accomplished leaders and some people, you know, just got reformed, everybody has passion. And so with that, how can we help people filter their passion into what you do and connect with you and learn more about the Public Welfare Foundation and support local community organizations doing justice reform that work with your efforts? Because a little bit helps, whether it be a thumbs up or a like or a little bit of bread here or there.
Exactly.
It can all help. And you guys have your hands in all these pots. How can we funnel them to you so people can express their passion? Because it doesn't take talent to hustle, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we connect them with you in this regard?
Yes. Well, we have just an incredible network of community-based organizations that we support across the country. Our website is very transparent, so you can see a list of those organizations, who we fund. What I would just say to folks is, if you're looking for an issue to really rally around or want to get more tapped into, you know, how you can, you know, support communities or support really good work, check out our website, look at the organizations that we fund, and, you know, pick one, decide if there's one that you want to support. We really do, I think, a great job of trying to amplify our partners. We're the organization that, as you said, Tony, like, we can provide the fuel and fund a lot of these groups. And so for us, it's about how can we make our those organizations more visible? And so I would just invite listeners, viewers to check out our website and just figure out how you can tap in. There may be a part of the country that you're particularly interested in or organization that you want to learn more about. But if you are looking for hope and inspiration, there are so many organizations out there that are doing really good work. So all is not lost. There's some good work happening out there.
So they would just go to www.publicwelfare.org or type in Public Welfare Foundation in any search engine, and it'll come up with all of your Twitters and Instagrams and Facebooks and whatnot.
Yes, we have an excellent Instagram, too. So encourage people to follow.
Okay, that's what's up. All right. Shout it out now.
Inspiring.
Well, I can tell you who inspired us today is you. You were fantastic. Absolutely. And knowing that we have people like yourself that are passionate and that are determined to really dive into this and help, you know, change. Change is difficult, let's be fair, right? And not only that, building a coalition of change makers can even be more difficult. But knowing that we have somebody like you, Thena Robinson Mock, to really make a big difference, not just in the lives where you are in Georgia, but through lives throughout the country. You're touching people, your organization is touching people that they don't even know, right? Yeah, you may see some wins here, this and that, or even the losses, but just knowing that these organizations have some organization like yours that can be their fuel to help them be able to do the things that they need to do to make this country better for all is fantastic. So we really appreciate you investing the time to coming on the Black Executive Perspective podcast, sharing your perspective and talking and educating us more about the Public Welfare Foundation.
Thank you. This was truly a pleasure.
Well, the pleasure was all ours, and we're definitely going to have you back, and we're going to put up on the website, put up on the show exactly where people, and we recommend that you guys, you probably have questions, whatever the case may be, or you might want to help, but don't whatever, definitely reach out to the Public Welfare Foundation. So we're thanking Thena Robinson Mock for being a part of a Black Executive Perspective podcast. So I think it's now time for
Tony's Tidbit.
Okay, and the tidbit today, justice does not move forward because one person has a title, one organization has a grant, or one leader has a microphone. Justice moves when people who refuse to quit decide to build it together. Thena Robinson Mock reminds us that coalition is not a buzzword. It is a discipline. It is a community under pressure choosing courage over comfort. The lesson is simple. When the moments get heavy, do not retreat into silence. Find your people, build the table, protect the work, and keep pushing justice forward. And you heard a lot of that from our new sister, Thena Robinson Mock.
Absolutely. So before we get out of here, we want to remind you that a Black Executive Perspective is more than just one podcast. It's a growing network of conversations designed to challenge perspectives and expand your understanding. So be sure to check out Need to Know with Dr. Nasinga Burton. Check out Pull Up Speak Up, where voices come together. And check out A Mixed Executive Perspective hosted by Grace Food and Corey. Different shows, different perspectives, but one mission, making the uncomfortable conversations comfortable. And then we always want to leave you with our call to action to incorporate LESS. Our mission here, our goal is to eliminate all forms of discrimination. And to achieve this, we're asking everyone to embrace LESS. The L stands for learn. Educate yourself on social, racial, cultural, and legal nuances.
Absolutely. And after you learn, you have the letter E, which stands for empathy. Now, since you've learned, now you can be more empathetic to your friends and colleagues because now you can put yourself in their shoes.
And then the first S stands for share. Share your insights and enlighten others. Don't hide it. Divide it.
Absolutely. And the final S stands for stop. We want everyone to help stop discrimination as it walks in your path. And this is so simple. If you're at the Sunday dinner table with Aunt Jenny or Uncle Joe and they say something that's inappropriate, instead of laughing or having your mouth open, you say, Aunt Jenny, Uncle Joe, we don't believe that. We don't say that. And you stop it right there. So if everyone can incorporate less, L-E-S-S, we'll build a more fair, more understanding world, and we all will see the change that we want to see, because less will become more.
Thank you again for tuning into this episode. Go in the catalog, check out some of our previous episodes, and look forward to great episodes coming up in the future. Go check out an episode with my girl Candace Jones, where she talks about being a social justice warrior, and it's powerful. So make sure you check that out. But go to the website, sign up for the newsletter, A Monthly Perspective, and it gives you nuggets and tidbits each month that come out on Wax. And then make sure that you leave us a review, subscribe, and tell us some things you'd like to hear about or people you'd like for us to talk to, and we'll try to get up with them. But where can they find us, Tony?
My brother, you can find the Black Executive Perspective podcast here on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow us on our social channels of LinkedIn, X, YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram at A Black Exec. For our fabulous guest, Stina Robinson Mock, Vice President of Public Welfare Foundation. For the co-host with the most, my boy down in Dallas, Chris P. Reed. I'm Tony Tidbit. We talked about it. We learned about it. We laughed about it. We were definitely inspired about it. We love you. And guess what? We're out.
A Black Executive Perspective.